Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Socialworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Thank you again for joining our fourth season, in which we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping industry. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being challenged, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Vikram Shyam, futurist for NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. Welcome, Vic.
Thanks, Diane. Yeah, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, and I have a background in aerospace, biomimicry, and foresight.
Thanks, Vic, and welcome, everyone. We're super excited about today's episode, where we'll be diving into the transformative world of regenerative agriculture and how it's paving the way for a more sustainable and nutrient-dense food system. Our guest today is Tina Owens, a true pioneer working at the intersection of agriculture, technology, human health, and prosperity. So with extensive experience at major food companies like Kellogg's and Danone, Tina is now the managing director of the Nutrient Density Alliance, focused on connecting consumers with regenerative agricultural practices. She brings a multi-generational farming perspective while also being at the forefront of exploring how cutting-edge technologies and innovations like AI, molecular mapping, and life cycle assessments can optimize and scale regenerative methods. We'll dive into the core principles today of regenerative agriculture, its role in enhancing soil health and combating climate change, and how emerging technologies are unlocking new insights into the nutritional potency of regenerative grown foods. Get ready for a great discussion filled with real-world examples and a vision for an ecosystemic future of food production that nourishes both people and the planet. Tina, welcome.
Thank you, Diane and Vic, for having me for this conversation. And while the lens of our conversation is viewing systems through the topics of nutrient density and regenerative agriculture systems, I'd like to say that I work with the broadest aim in mind for propelling forward systems of transformation towards climate and decarbonization goals. We tend to think of solutions through the mindset of impacts to GDP, but biodiversity, not GDP, is the only metric that matters for sustaining human life going forward. And we need a collective groundswell of leaders who choose to work in service of the opportunities for necessary outcomes to sustain nature, and therefore all life on this planet going forward. It's a pleasure to be with you both today, and I'm really looking forward to diving into this conversation together.
Oh, very cool, Tina. Thanks for joining us. Looking forward to a great discussion and getting into the weeds on this. No pun intended. But before we get started on that, maybe for newbies like me to the topic, can you just explain a bit what is regenerative agriculture? How is it different from conventional farming practice? And what are the main principles involved?
Yeah. So regenerative agriculture is a resurfacing of indigenous practices within food systems that's focused on soil health and its relation to above and below ground biodiversity, upstream and downstream effects, and systems like mycorrhizal fungal networks, which connect plants beneath the soil and actually sequester a great deal of the world's carbon. A mainstream definition of regenerative agriculture was introduced in 2017 by Chico State, and it includes foundational practices like no and no tillage, cover crops, crop rotations, and animal and manure integration, which are at the base of all existing regenerative ag definitions. There's a lot of conversations that there is no standard definition, but I am here to argue that there actually is a shared foundation. And so some efforts within regenerative agriculture focus on practice-based adoption, others on outcomes related to soil regeneration and rebuilding soil organic matter that has been lost from decades of extractive conventional agriculture, especially tillage and the application of biocides that kill the living nature of the soil in a way that leads to ongoing deleterious effects. So soils are the largest store of terrestrial carbon on Earth and are therefore a massively critical pillar of any climate change mitigation efforts. Both above and below ground biodiversity loss can be directly attributed to conventional agricultural practices. And regenerative agriculture is experiencing a surge in interest in relation to its ability to help with recharging aquifers through better rainfall penetration, driving local water cycles by actually seeding clouds through continuous living cover, allowing biodiversity to re-enter the ecosystem, including pollinators, which are completely fundamental to the entire food system, and using nature-based systems as agricultural solutions instead of chemical-based interventions. And it's worth noting, 68 out of the top 100 food companies in the world have something around regenerative agriculture, either specific commitments around farmer payments or acreage conversion or crop conversion. And there's also an overlap with their science-based target goals. 70 of those top 100 food companies have an existing science-based target initiative goal, and that focuses on scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. Well, 75 to 90% of emissions from the food system are in scope 3. So the overlap between regenerative agriculture, scope 3 emissions reduction, and SBTI goals is incredibly important. So regenerative agriculture is being heavily scrutinized for its ability to help buffer against some of the drastic impacts of climate change and the potential for food and system disruptions related to our warming planet. It's not a panacea, but it's a very important and critical tool within our box.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear about the nature-based interventions you mentioned, Tina, because so natural systems tend to use, like they use water rather than chemicals, reduce energy usage, reduce material usage, more about structure and information. So I'm a big fan of that. I'm glad you mentioned it. Diane?
Also, yeah, thanks, Vic. And I'm also appreciating hearing a lot of the kind of the network build out of the approach, the network of networks and the appreciation for and the design for kind of benefits across multiple constituents within this ecosystem. Tina, Vic and I spent a lot of time in this series and in our work together, exploring ecosystemic models, kind of examining how change impacts industry and economy and society and policy, and based on the fact that the world is increasingly interconnected. And we monitor closely the parallels with nature-based ecosystems as well, and how that can inform industry-based ecosystems. But the ecosystems in industry that we examine are often facing similar challenges or opportunities, right? So kind of a common mission or vision or purpose tends to bring these networks together, where they're able to leverage kind of general purpose technologies or more collaborative models. Ecosystemic models can be quite helpful too in offering pathways to increase synergies, distribute risk across a broader network, displacing some of the levels of conflict with collaboration. So maybe walk us through, if you can, what some of the challenges that farmers are facing today with making that transition to regenerative methods. How do the economics of regenerative agriculture compare to conventional approaches in terms of yields and profitability? Are the economics favorable in kind of navigating that shift? Is that compelling enough on its own, or does it need some subsidization in order to encourage the shift? What does that look like for the farmers and for the network?
Well, tackling the subsidy conversation, certainly the subsidies are actually working against us at the moment by underpinning systems that we know are actually providing poor outcomes as it relates to ecosystem services overall. So that's certainly its own category and topic to dive into. As it relates to farm transition, there's a mindset shift that has to occur. And actually, many farmers end up at the door of regenerative agriculture because they're unable to continue affording some of those expensive tools, interventions, and inputs that are coming from off the farm onto the farm to lead to yield, not fertility, but yield. And so we have to unpack the multiple system dynamics that are at play on how farmers have the ability to adopt regenerative ag practices. And then, of course, you have human nature of the innovators, the first adopters, the mainstream. Regenerative agriculture is actually starting to tip into the mainstream conversation as it relates to major ag producers. And certainly the conversation's gotten a lot more complex over the last year or two as some of those company commitments have come out. But one of the major dynamics that is at play, Diane, that you mentioned, is the on-farm economics. And there is considerable research that's been aggregating over the course of 5 to 7 years that regenerative agriculture practices do meaningfully increase on-farm economic activity and outcome. And it's because of the reduction of synthetic inputs and the introduction of things like cover crops and crop rotation and no-and low-till that remove the need for that outside intervention, which of course has its own emissions factor tied to how it's produced, shipped, distributed, utilized on farm, et cetera. We also have the issue of age for farmers and intergenerational transfer. The current average age of farmers is 57 years old. That's from the Ag Census of 2022, which was actually just released last month. So that's as recent as the data comes from a government perspective. And most income within farming households is actually driven by off-farm jobs held by a spouse or part-time by the farmer and to provide things like health insurance. And then there are perverse incentives that work against us in the system where for the next generation to buy into the farm, they need to go to ag school so that the ag lender will invest in them. But then they end up taking on student debt to go to school. And then that debt keeps them from being able to get the debt they would need to purchase a farm. And not only that, there's a lot of different approaches that the younger generation under the 45 crowd would actually like to use as it relates to things like organic and regenerative farming. And the current system of crop insurance and ag lending does not recognize those as well-established practices. And so it actually keeps the gate to the system of change intact because you don't have the same de-risking pieces in the system that you have for just standard corn, soy, wheat rotation within a commoditized food system. So trying to cover basic needs on farm for economic systems that farms developed in different political and economic times, right? When you're 57, 60, that means you've had multiple decades at this, and there were certainly different policies and support systems under which that equity was created. And in many cases, that generational equity is not able to be passed on because then the next generation has to buy you out. So they may be taking on debt that you don't even have and then are not able to have additional income on the farm to be able to pay for that debt. So we're looking at one of the largest land handovers that has ever occurred in our society as it relates to the intergenerational transfer or lack thereof, as it relates to agriculture. And currently you have carbon intensive ingredients that are subsidized at $43 billion a year. So what would it look like if we were actually able to move those billions into cover crops, crop rotation, regional regenerative food systems, et cetera? And so going back just to put a finer point on the on-farm profitability, the Soil Health Institute, the American Farmland Trust, and even the AgriGiant Cargill have done really specific work across multiple crops, cotton and almonds and standard corn, soy, wheat rotation, and some of the other cash crops that are typical of American farms, and have really specific case studies that are either by commodity or by state or by region that can be tapped into to understand the specifics of on-farm transition costs and the increased profitability outcome. And there are some scientists in this space that say that there is an immediate outcome in profitability, but it depends on the state of the soils you start with. So if you're starting from completely degraded soils, you're likely to encounter some transition costs as you work your way back into soil fertility. If you're starting from a space that has not been quite so disrupted, perhaps it was in hay or alfalfa for several years, you might actually be able to profitably raise row crops on that using a polyculture system in regenerative agriculture, which could lead to on-farm profitability much sooner. So with that, I'll pass it back.
I guess you mentioned several things. So student loan debt that's been in the news recently, how it's connected to agriculture. That's an interesting angle on that. You mentioned also something that alludes, I guess, to polycultures of planting different kinds of species. So I want to shift to the sustainability angle. So you also mentioned the profitability, all of that stuff. But many companies are trying to sell sustainability by saying you're going to get carbon offsets, you're going to reforest or plant trees. And very often it's introducing homogeneity into the system. So maybe could you talk a little bit about polyculture versus monoculture and where this the whole carbon offset stuff is at? And then there's also related to that is the whole like synthetic food system that's being developed, is like the Beyond Meats and synthetic meats, things like that. So what are your views on all of that?
Yeah, that's a very wide-ranging question, Vic, and I will certainly endeavor to cover the whole thing. Let's start really quick with carbon offsets. Those are being purchased and used mostly by those that have fossil fuel greenhouse gas emissions to offset, whereas within the agricultural system, it's typically talked about as insetting. And then you get into the potential around double accounting. So that carbon that's associated with that commodity crop is only counted once. And so there are a considerable number of consortiums that are working on how to keep the payment for carbon as low as possible to combine it with the commodity outcome at the type of prices that the industry is used to enjoying. And what that actually does is it's a sharp corporate elbow coming at farmers as it relates to the scope 3 emissions reduction and the decarbonization that's needed within the food system. That is not without its complexities, and we could probably spend about 30 to 45 minutes talking about just that. The macro lens on regenerative agriculture, you mentioned polyculture versus monoculture. This is incredibly important for us to understand in every single agricultural system, whether it's kelp in the ocean, whether it's almonds in California, or whether it's row crops in Iowa. Biomimicry in food production through multi-species integration, that is what kicks forward the fertility within the soil that creates the benefits to plants, to pollinators, to water infiltration, to building soil organic matter. And it's incredibly important not only to maintain that, but to rebuild it back across the food system in order to rebuild the ecosystem structures. So nutrient density is in there. The healthy pollinators piece I mentioned before, that biodiversity is the single most important metric that we have going forward for human life. Our agriculture system has bred varieties for quantity outcomes and yield. And that's how the farmers even think about it. They don't even think at a profitability per acre perspective. That's not the vernacular used by the system. It's what yield did you get? And how did it compare to your neighbors? And so we even have to retrain the farms in the system to be thinking as a business as it relates to their profitability per acre, not the quantity outcomes. So as a result, there's multiple system breakdowns, not only within agriculture, but also translating some of these impacts into human health impacts upstream and downstream. So you have the runoffs that's occurring in the ecosystem. You have the above and below ground biodiversity loss. You have the fact that we've ignored some of these upstream and downstream effects for multiple decades in commodity agriculture. And so what's interesting is that the current system, the way we measure this, does not actually account for the true cost of food. And so we're missing some of the really big components and understanding more about the tools in our belt to be able to shift the way of thinking. And one of those is actually life cycle assessments. So the life cycle assessment methodology actually was built by the chemical industry in the mid-1970s. And through a year and a half of talking with everybody that I could that has any detailed understanding of this, I learned that it does, in fact, exclude organic, perennial, regenerative, and indigenous managed lands. It's based on field passes, diesel use, fossil fuels integrated, gases, food production, transportation, recycling. It's not based on above and below ground biodiversity. The difference between a date palm that's planted once every 2 to 3 decades versus a beet sugar that's planted annually, it treats those two things as the same. One requires high inputs and a massive amount of infrastructure to develop, and the other requires almost no inputs and also gives you sugar. So we're not having the right brass tacks conversation about the energy intensity or the fossil fuel inputs that actually go into some of these outcomes, because we're excluding the 50%+ of the agricultural system globally, organics, perennials, regenerative, indigenous managed lands. We're excluding those, the ones that we actually need to exist as a society and to help with mitigating climate change. You had mentioned synthetic biology, which is an important factor in here because of the energy intensity to create some of those solutions. And the fact that it kind of sucks the air out of the room a bit as it relates to defending animal agriculture and the need for animals on land the same way it would have existed before we had urban sprawl and the developed world that we live in. There were way more animals on the land than what we have today. And they were not leading to climate change outcomes. What does lead to climate change outcomes is the way that we raise those animals and the type of agricultural environments and stresses that we put in them and shipping in food from elsewhere. And so that's its own conversation. The synthetic biology conversation is being held up as an equal substitute and a solution for climate change. And there are, by my practitioner count, 5 different types of synthetic biology. One of them actually has a lot of beneficial meaningfulness to it that could be integrated in the food system. But let's start with just naming what they are. That you have the lab-based meat, potentially harvested cells or synthesized molecules under precision fermentation, incredibly energy intensive. The life cycle assessments already show that. You have bioengineering and CRISPR, are altered genomes with potential unknown long-term effects. And the reason they make that assertion is because the existing genetic modification bioengineering that exists in the world, while there are some benefits that can be pointed to, like yield, that is only if you put blinders on to the upstream and downstream effects of the climate change impacts that we've had from a fossil fuel impact and from the constant tillage and disruption of natural systems. That's for-profit research. It's not science when you're deliberately excluding what's happening upstream and downstream from your system. And so there's been a long-term cost associated with what the original promise was of those systems. And because the CRISPR gene editing piece is not currently regulated, there's no registry of a genome that's been mapped and what's being changed. It creates incredible potential for ecosystem disruption by unregistered entities, including someone in their garage, not just large bio companies that are interested in seeing the change there. There's the cloning of existing animals and animal genetics, which is a new kind of monoculture. It's taking already the overused genetics that exist within the food system and extending them further by through replication. Just for example, there was a study done in the recent past that showed that the dairy industry, you can trace the semen back to two bull cows from the 1950s for all of the genetics that have currently been in the dairy system since then. And so we've already been creating monocultures to the exclusion of natural systems and human health outcomes. And now we're doubling down on it with the potential cloning of animals. And then you have 3D printed food, which there's been a lot of recent attention paid to how foods are processed. And so rather than focusing on 3D printed food, let me share an example. If we grew regenerative wheat and it had 40% higher protein, but then we put it through a extrusion process that actually changed the molecules of that protein fundamentally, that it caused an inflammatory response within our bodies, it didn't matter how it was grown. What matters was how it was processed. And Hubert Laszlo Barabasi at the Northeastern University, who coined the term nutritional dark matter, he and his team actually published peer-reviewed science, I think it was in Nature Food a year and a half ago, talking about how they mapped the standard mathematical equation that all whole foods share, and then the standard deviation of 50,000 processed foods that exist in the grocery stores today that we're all eating. And they were able to show how processed that food was by how far the deviation was from the standard mathematical equation of whole foods. So we now know how to measure this. And with the molecular mapping of food, using AI to tie that to human health outcomes, there's additional implications coming there for how food is processed and what it means. And then the fifth category that I'm actually a fan of, because we've already talked about the mycorrhizal fungal community, is the fungal and mushroom-based proteins that can be produced anywhere very cheaply using existing standard equipment that the food industry already has in everybody's backyard. And some examples of that would be Meaty or Nature's Find as examples. And it was actually Nature's Find that taught me about the fact that their mushroom-based proteins could be replicated using existing equipment, which means it's low overhead, high output, high quality proteins based on systems our bodies recognize inherently as food, and therefore could be incredibly meaningful in reducing the carbon footprint and transportation footprints of food systems going forward, and don't have some of the embedded downsides that we can already see from past and current systems that are in the other synthetic biology categories that I just mentioned. And with that, I'll pass it back to you.
But thanks. So you brought up a couple of things. One was the bull semen going back to, you know, two specific specimen. Brought up, you know, humans have been kind of doing this for the last 7,000 to 8,000 years with agriculture, right? We're trying to increase yield, like you said, and that's been our goal. So we did that with wheat and several other species. But anyway, so it's kind of like shifting our mindset that's, you know, evolutionarily baked in. But you mentioned some things related to transportation, like so Diane was talking about that related to life cycle as well. So you talked about shipping, you talked about runoff, you talked about offsets. And it seems like these are places where maybe agriculture, the food system intersects with transportation, could be with rail, with aviation. So is the transportation / airport airline community plugged in to regenerative agriculture? And if not, what are the impacts? Are we seeing any of these impacts? And then what are the biggest voices on both sides?
Yeah, there's a big component from transportation that matters both for the agricultural sector, but also for the transportation sector. And one of the most specific examples that we can point to is the biofuels that exist currently off of things like corn, corn ethanol, and the fact that 40% of the acres in the U.S. from corn actually go into ethanol production. And those are subsidized acres. They're not grown regeneratively. But imagine the impact that could happen if we actually were to be able to integrate regenerative practices specific to even that 40% acreage of corn. And the greenhouse gas footprint that would be reduced, if not in the transportation sector, at least from the way that those crops were managed and grown, including the continuous living cover and the impact to the local ecosystems. So what I do know from talking with colleagues throughout the industry is that there is a renewed sense of interest, especially in biofuels from the aviation industry perspective, and using biomass from various crops to introduce into that sector. And it's because of the decarbonization goals that they have relative to the Paris Climate Agreement and their own science-based target initiative. And so they have a role to play. The ethanol system has a role to play in regenerative agriculture. And it leads to my assertion that almost every major commodity industry that exists in the world could have a regenerative agriculture system at its base, including the transportation industry as it relates to how biofuels are created. So one of the things I might mention there, just to go a little bit deeper, is that some of the runoff, the barren dirt, the tillage that occurs relative to those crops that are created for biofuels, there's just layer upon layer of complexity and deleterious outcomes related to how those crops are created. And so not only would it have an instant impact on the carbon footprint, it would serve as an example for where the other food systems and ecological systems could go next. So I continue to remain hopeful that introducing plant biofuels, whether it's for textiles or food or packaging or automobile components or transportation, that by putting regenerative agriculture at the foundational base, that those systems could be decarbonized in ways that we haven't even begun to imagine, but we have not yet changed our mindsets to integrate those natural solutions as the first thing that we should be after. So thank you for the question.
Yeah, we find in our study of ecosystems and the ecosystem shift across any sector, the mindset shift has to precede, right, a lot of the methodology shifts, right? You have to lead with education and kind of be compelling storytelling in order to encourage that new vision for what success looks like. Maybe, Tina, double-clicking on and maybe shifting back to some of the general principles of the field. Some of the research that we're seeing suggests that industrial grown foods may compromise nutrient density. Do you agree with that? And if so, how can regenerative methods start to reverse this trend? And can maybe you walk us through some of the how regenerative agriculture can help improve biodiversity, ecosystem health, and what role does soil health and biodiversity or do soil health and biodiversity play in increasing nutrient density?
Yeah, so they're definitely interlinked. And I love that you mentioned the mindset shift and the compelling storytelling, because that's one of the first things I've found is finding ways to kind of break people's acceptance of the way things are so that you can kind of know that there are additional ways to work has been one of the most important things as part of my work across the CPG industry and helping shift mindsets. So when you ask about the nutrient density of crops related to soil health and biodiversity, it's impacting every part of the food system. So it's not just about varietal selection, but it's also about the soil that it's grown in. And the mix of the two is where the nexus of outcomes has been. But our varietal selection, similar to dairy industry genetic refining, has been selection for ship and shelf life and how well that monoculture product, like the Red Delicious apple, so to speak, how well that one system can be scaled and made efficient in order to maximize the number of stores and shelves that it's on, not for the taste of that product, not for the outcome. And because of the disruptive tillage and or biocide practices that are inherent in some of those cropping systems, even with tree crops, you have systems that have been so oversprayed that they have actually been integrated into the tree genetics itself. And so even if the tree is no longer sprayed, it's still with inherent to the tree and what it's providing in the food outcome. We've removed several of the key systems that lead to nutrient density uptake, especially the mycorrhizal fungal community that translates between the soil and the plant for that nutrition uptake. And in fact, some of the existing breeding programs, some of my agronomist friends have told me that recent breeds of plants in the commodity system have been so developed with the outside inputs in mind, the synthetic inputs, that even if you were to take that plant and plant it in the most biodiverse soil that exists on the planet, it has lost the ability to signal with the soil for that nutrient uptake. And so it's completely reliant on the intervention from human and artificial means. So what, coming back to nutrient density, this is systemic as an issue underpinning all parts of our food sector, but also all parts of our health sector. So for example, more than 45% of the US population has existing nutrient gaps, probably a little bit higher, but most of our standardized testing only looks at a few components to see what the outcomes are. According to Tufts in their recent Food as Medicine and True Cost of Food report, the economic costs of our suboptimal diets lead to healthcare spending and lost productivity that's $1.1 trillion a year, which equals the economic output of the entire food sector. So we're spending just as much on health and ill health as we are on what the food sector makes. So terrible disconnect there, or rather terrible connection there, in everything affecting fertility to longevity to metabolic disease, multiple generation impacts, in utero impacts from the heavy chemical use that exists in industrial agriculture. And then going back to the mycorrhizal fungal community, there's some work by Bob Bielman at Penn State and also the Rodale Institute as it relates to when that mycorrhizal fungal community that signals in the soil, all of the different trading that occurs between the plant and the atmosphere in the soil, there's critical antioxidants that we lose that we don't get back. And one in particular is ergothionine. And the only place that we can get that is from plants. And mycorrhizal fungal community is incredibly critical to that uptake within plants. Well, when you're missing from your food system, you have extremely higher rates of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia, and mental health issues. And there's been studies that have shown that in some countries like the UK, where they have some inherently higher ergothionine levels, there is correlated. Their rates of those neurodegenerative diseases are lower. And in our society in the US, it's much higher because of the agricultural practices that have led to that being stripped, really stripped from the food system and from the soil system. Now, this also means when we're not getting the right nutrients in our food, there's hidden hunger and malnourishment issues. And we tend to think of that as being someone that's visibly malnourished. They're really thin. They look like they need to eat something. But it's also obesity. And this is not me asserting, this is the UNFAO talking about hidden hunger and the lack of nutrition, the right macronutrients, micronutrients in our food, that your eat signal stays on because you're not getting those basic nutrients. And so you're constantly eating, trying to find those nutrients, and you can't turn that signal off because your body is walking around. Hangriness is literally your body at the beginning of a lack of nutrients, and something that you would want to get to the bottom of, because it can lead to metabolic diseases and other things later in life. But where I get really concerned is that this also has national security implications. So 77% of age-appropriate recruits are unable to qualify for military service, according to Mission Readiness, which is a nonprofit that started by retired generals. And they were focusing on school lunches and obesity and lack of physical activity. Well, those are lifestyle diseases. So you're telling me that the graduates from high school already have enough lifestyle diseases that only 23% of them are willing, can even pass the basics of what's required to join the military. And then how many of them actually want to join the military? No wonder the military has a hard time meeting their recruitment quotas, right? Like, it's all interconnected. There's another example that does not get talked about a lot that I am delighted to share here, just because we need to internalize this level of thinking. And it's how pollinator gaps in the ecosystem drive nutrient deficiency. So a dear friend of mine who leads scientific research for the Organic Center in the US, Dr. Amber Skilligo, she actually did her PhD work and some of her postdoc work on pollinators related to strawberry nutrient density. And what she found was when you have larger honeybees, they stay at the outside of the petals in pollination for strawberries. And the smaller solitary pollinators that have been kind of killed off within the ecosystem, they actually get inside the inner petals. And not having the right level of pollination leads to deformed food, lack of nutrient uptake. And you can actually taste it when you taste the strawberry. The strawberry tastes like cardboard. It might look fine, but your tongue knows, because taste is actually tied to nutrients. It's your body telling you that there's something missing when you eat that strawberry and it doesn't taste like a strawberry. There's also some initial research, and I won't belabor it because I know we're coming up on time, but beyond hunger and nutrition gaps, there's been studies that show that there's food waste implications. Higher nutrient-dense food can go farther in the food system and last longer on shelf while providing a better eating outcome for consumers that purchase it. And some of my colleagues in the food system in Regenerative Ag have found that when they test the top two, and when they test the allergens in two of the top eight allergenic commodities, they find that the allergens are either almost not present or non-existent in Regenerative Ag systems. So there's even the anaphylactic shock and allergen outcomes related to Regenerative Ag systems versus chemically intensive conventional food production. So there's just so many more places to go with this. And with that, I will turn it back to keep the conversation going.
Thanks, Mina. So much wonderful new information. Yeah, I didn't know that taste and nutrients are linked. So say no to food pills, I guess. Is that what you're saying? But I guess just wrapping things up, what are your takes on the biggest challenges facing regenerative agriculture in general?
So the first one is that there's currently a lack of funding in specific intervention spaces needed to get the wholesale conversion to regen ag. Most of those large companies I mentioned earlier that have a regenerative ag commitment are trying like heck not to have to pay a premium associated with that. However, they're looking at it through the lens of commodity pricing and not through the lens of infrastructure, shoring up their infrastructure for their business going forward. So they almost need to look at it through a capital investment perspective, like a food production line. If they're not willing to invest in regenerative agriculture conversion, the very things that their businesses are based on are going to start to crumble right before their eyes. And in fact, already have. Unilever talks about how back in 2015, they were spending $440 million a year on climate change mitigation interventions within their food system. It's now a decade later. And I have no doubt that number is even higher. They're already paying for this. Furthermore, when the climate change interruptions happen in commoditized food systems, we're going to see prices go haywire either way. So you are not going to get away from paying for this cost. You're either paying for it in the ongoing business disruption or you're going to pay for it in future commodity costs. Why not spend that money now in helping to convert the system into something that's really needed? And we talked earlier about the life cycle assessment methodology. That is definitely a glaring thing for me, because if you were to take all of the existing life cycle assessments globally and push them into an AI system and start asking questions, you would not realize that the answers are fundamentally flawed because they're excluding biofuels, animal feed, and derivatives like high fructose corn syrup. That's literally what those systems were designed to measure, not the ability of a company to mitigate climate change. So we're trying to answer questions with the wrong tools, but also using new tools to answer questions using bad data. And there's a whole other conversation, Vic, I'm sure you and I could have about the ways that the things are manifesting themselves in the food system, but I will kick it back to you.
Thanks, Tina. I guess maybe we can wrap up by sharing some of the big takeaways that we have from this. So for me specifically, I learned that soil is, again, I'm going to go with my bad puns. Soil is the bedrock of pretty much all the UN Sustainable Development Goals, all the issues. It's tied into everything you mentioned, trillions of dollars in costs, not paying attention to it. And then focusing more on the transportation and aviation side, seems like there's a tie-in through the economics of it, fuels, offsets, operations. There's also the movement of goods. There's the forecasting stuff, getting into the life cycle assessment. Then there's the impacts for manufacturing, so we talk about runoffs, things like that. Then our future workforce is also at risk. You talked about health impacts. So it seems like overall soil regenerative agriculture seems to be at the crux of a lot of the issues we're facing. So I'd like to get your big takeaways, Tina. What would you like us to...
Yeah, so you hit on a lot of them in that it's permeating the food and agricultural system, but with promise to impact other big systems like health, human nutrition, fertility, longevity, and our future ability to help mitigate climate change. I, for one, do not want to see a climate volatile world where toaster pastries and synthetic biology are what's backstopping our food system. And in order to not live in that future, because that's definitely one of the potential futures, we need to be heads down in deliberately investing in food system transformation right now. And I'll leave you with two thoughts. One is a video by Science Moms, which is a consortium of 1,000 scientific moms, called Later is Too Late. It's 60 seconds. It talks about the fact that by the time a child born today goes to college, it may be too late to leave them the world we promised. We have one human birth to adult lifetime left to act. The other is from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, which talks about if nothing changes by 2050, the food system alone will have used up 2/3 of the remaining global carbon budget. We have to start acting now, and we cannot stop. And so I really appreciate the chance to have this conversation with you both, Diane and Vic. Thank you so much for inviting me. I look forward to seeing where this path takes us next.
Yeah, Tina, thank you. I have learned so much. You've really inspired me. I'm just listening to all of these implications, right? I have this incredible sense of urgency, right? I can imagine that if we start now, we have a very long path ahead. If we are all focused on the right pathway with intention and urgency, it's still going to take us a while to get to a really good place on this, but we have to, right? The implications are extraordinary and existential. But I do love, again, the work that we do here is really focused on understanding ecosystemic implications and futures. And I love the interconnectivity that I'm hearing. So we can, I think, lean in to this, right, this area, and really, to your point, draw major beneficial impacts on workforce strategies and futures and healthcare strategies and futures, right? And so we really appreciate, Tina, your perspective here and the work that you're leading. For our listeners, please, if this is of interest to you, and how could it not be, please do follow Tina's work and important work. And we would encourage you also to keep in touch with us through the Ecosystemic Futures podcast and the Apple Future or the Apple podcast channel, or wherever you get your favorite podcast content. And you can always catch us on socialmorks.com. But Tina, thank you again. Vic, thank you. This has been a brilliant conversation, and look forward to keeping in touch.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks, Tina.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at socialmorks.com.